Hello, grandkids, and welcome to Stunt Granny Audio Presents OPA number 130. This is Kevin DeFrango. Sitting to my left is Ken Phillips. What is going on, good sir?
Hey, man. Good to be back. Making a semi-regular thing here. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, even though I made a big deal about posting that other one quickly due to events in real life, I have not gotten up the must-post Steelers draft review as of the recording of this. It's still going up probably as we record this.
Yeah, I think it we'll let history judge us, but I think it'll end up being okay to get this way our listeners will be able to kind of grade our judgments in a way a little bit more, maybe. After the time has passed a little bit, they'll be able to listen to our insightful comments and really kind of appreciate the wisdom that has now kind of become common in the days that have passed. So yeah, or that's one possibility anyway, Kevin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Soak up our wisdom, Steelers fans. I know that's why everyone's here. All the Steelers talk.
That's right.
Especially our good buddy Josh. He just loves the Steelers. And he's got Baker Mayfield. He's happy now.
Well, yeah, good. I hope the Browns can turn it around this year. I think that's always interesting. Or that was always a pretty interesting rivalry, I think, growing up. So, in a way, that would be nice to get back again.
It does seem like that rivalry is going to be legitimate. It started this year. I'm not sure the first game maybe fell into that category.
Yeah,
but even though the Steelers won that second one, it was definitely a game, man.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's going to continue to be a game, if not even tougher, with them getting Odell Beckham Jr. As the receiver. I still think that their line is terrible and that the Steelers can blitz them to death. But that's my personal opinion.
Hey, not to get a little off tangent here, but and related to NFL news, I guess we didn't mention that the that other football league, which I can't even remember what it was called now, apparently folded and ceased operation. I guess now's not the year. This wasn't the year for the secondary football
market
to take off. Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's kind of funny. In a lot of ways, it makes Vince McMahon look at least smart-ish.
Really?
Like,
I want to hear this take.
Well, it seemed he announced a new league coming in 2021. And everyone kind of made fun of him for it because it was like, he did it last year, 2018, or maybe even 2017.
Yeah, it was a while. Yeah, I wouldn't be too surprised if it was 17, but yeah.
Yeah, it was either 17 or 18. So everyone's like, why the hell is that taking so long? And then this other league comes out and they're like, oh, hey, we're going to do this right now. And I don't know, maybe he's just organizing things better than they are for, well, which is why it disbanded, I would obviously argue. When you only operate for 6 weeks or something like that, because they didn't even make it through the full season.
No, they did not. They had some kind of rescue investor kind of come in, and then I think he just kind of shut it down, maybe after taking a look at sort of the lay of the land, I guess. But they didn't finish the season, and it was just I guess they weren't sure how long their insurance and stuff would be lasting and stuff like that. So that's kind of a bummer. But I think they were relying on being able to sign NFL players who weren't playing or something like that to have access to somehow get access to some NFL players to be able to play like maybe the backups or something like that, in their league. And the NFL was not interested in having that happen.
No, I mean, as an NFL player at this point, I would not be interested in that happening. I mean, you can see how bad things can go.
Well, for sure. Especially when it's a league where they had, that one of their advertising points was less rules regarding player safety, you know, like more dramatic, you know, big hits and things like that. So that's probably not the best selling point for a talented player to want to take part in that league. I'm just thinking.
Yeah, I mean, so knowing what most people know now, there's certainly people that understand the precautions that most of these leagues are intending to go with.
To me, I guess it's just another sort of, you know, exhibit to say like a secondary NFL league has, or football league has not ever worked. And well, unless you count, I guess, the AFL, which whenever that was.
Well, yeah, eventually it was merged. Morphed into the NFL. I mean, I guess, yeah, but I mean, it's honestly at this point, it's, and it's another subject that would come up until we start talking about paying college players, or at least college football players who bring in just boatloads of money to universities. You know, there's no reason for a secondary market. Like, it's like you go from college and you're good enough for the pros or you're not.
Yeah. I mean, if you could, though, make a living playing football and you weren't good enough for the NFL.
Yeah, and I guess there's always, it seems like there's always a few people from those leagues that get a chance, no matter which league has popped up. Oh, you know what I mean? The XFL, I mean, we've talked about Tommy Maddox before, going back to the Steelers.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
He was part of the XFL.
That's right. Because he was, didn't he, well, he got to the championship. Didn't
yeah, he won the championship, I think, with his team. I don't remember.
It was an exciting season, I know that much.
Yeah.
And I was excited to, when they had got, you know, they picked him up after that. And, you know, he was a hit or miss kind of quarterback, I guess. But that's probably a good example of, like, somebody that a team, like, I feel like the Steelers were lucky to have him, though. As terrible as their quarterbacks had been.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that he took over for Cordell, didn't he? Because that was after Cordell had his confidence completely shattered at some point.
Did he take after Cordell, or it wasn't Malone? That would have been too long ago.
Oh, yeah, that's too long ago. It's either Cordell or they wouldn't have been Bubby Brister. That's too late.
Oh. Could it have been Maddox after Brister? I don't know. We're going to have to
our researchers are hard at work here. Trying to Wikipedia this.
Wow.
Yeah, as a backup to Cordell Stewart.
Oh, you got it.
2001.
Yeah, Cordell was definitely a hit and miss, hot and cold quarterback. That was a little, I guess, pre-internet meme that we had in our apartment back in college. Somebody printed out a little sign with some word art that was like Cordell Stewart. It said Cordell Stewart is not Jesus, but you could put a piece of tape over not, depending on like how he was doing that week. which I thought was kind of funny.
That is pretty amusing. Yeah, it would be interesting to go back and watch that. I feel like there are some people that have made me think that the end of his career wasn't as bad as it really was.
Yeah.
That it may have been more blame should be placed on other sources along with him.
Slash. I was just remembering that. Slash, I can't believe I forgot his nickname. Well, I don't know how we got talking about the Steelers again this week, Kevin. People who were thirsty for more coverage
you wanted to talk about the AAFL or AAF.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I got us off topic a little bit there. But yeah, that's true. I don't know. To me, it's another reason to say, like, not sure the XFL is going to be able to be successful either.
Oh, Yeah, well, and I still think it has the same problem. Even though some guys like a Tommy Maddox will get a chance,
yeah,
and you know, there's still kind of a limited market. I mean, the CFL still happens, and it does seem like there are still some players that the NFL picks up from the CFL. And between that and college, I just don't really see a whole lot of a need for it.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, I don't know. Is there room for a minor league? Like, I don't know. It seems like there's not enough players out there necessarily, but, you know, good luck to McMahon if he thinks he can pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm not excited about it. I don't really care about extra football. I'm watching the NFL and some college, and I'm good.
Yeah.
And that's enough football for me.
But,
so, Ken, another love of mine.
Yeah, besides football.
Besides football. Now, I don't know if I'd say, per se, that death metal is maybe a love. But I don't think that the song played in this article was not the heaviest song I've ever heard. And it was not the most growly I have ever heard. Like, I could make out the lyrics for the most part. Even though I had not heard of this band before. That's in an article entitled, "Death Metal Music Inspires Joy, Not Violence."
Yeah, I wonder if how much of that is necessarily drawn strictly from the article's conclusions, but it was an interesting study. And as you mentioned, it was involving a genre of music known as death metal.
Yeah, Bloodbath.
Oh, the name of the band.
The name of the band.
Bloodbath. And the song was, I want to say, 2017, maybe? Or no, 2012. So, yes, it's been about 7 years since that one came out. It was a, we gave it a listen just to acclimatize ourselves, and you're right. It was, I would say, a lot heavier than what I am into, but it actually wasn't that bad. I mean, it was kind of catchy in a weird way.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely had some solid... that's the one thing for death metal that kind of gets me, like, the singing, it gets a little too, as some people call it, Cookie Monster.
Like, it almost makes you laugh that it's like someone doing a scary voice or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, and those bands just like, come on, man, like, but even them sometimes now, like, I try to... Not that I always listen to it, but I try to block that off and hear, like, the guitar and, like, all the other work that's going on. And it's just like, oh my gosh, like, some of them are so good and so fast. Mm. That it's just like, oh my lord, like, this is, you're ruining it with this, the singing, man. You're just killing me here.
It is weird that I wonder what the history of that aesthetic is, like, who kind of was the first to, come up with that as a good idea, and everyone else is sort of like, yes, yes.
I know that there's this guy Ian Christie that has written like all of these different books on heavy metal and the history to it.
Interesting.
So I'm sure that he has that covered somewhere, but it's been a while. Like, I mean, I remember seeing bands like that college.
Right.
So, I mean, as we talked about, there are some albums that were released while we were in college that are now 25 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like this kind of music's been around for a while.
So, yeah, it has definitely at least been our lifetime, you know, because I don't think it was quite that heavy when we were younger, but it did happen sometime within our sphere. Like, because, you know, at one point, Black Sabbath was considered, like, really heavy. And, like, you listen to Bloodbath here. And, you know, it's quite a progression from one to the other.
Yeah, I mean, would you see, like, typo negative being sort of like the missing link there almost in between those two, two styles of singing? I don't know. It's almost a midpoint of sorts.
Yeah, well, Peter Steele just had a great bass voice. Like, I don't think there's anything... Like, it was embarrassing how deep and awesome his voice was. Like, him dying is still just such a bummer. I still have one of his... He ripped all the strings off of his bass at the end of the show that we saw him at. And he threw the chords into the crowd. I caught one of them, and I still have it.
That's pretty cool.
But the guy was, what, 6'8", 6'9"? He looked like a professional wrestler. Like, I mean, he was built like one. And, I mean, he was famously in Playgirl because he had a large unit.
Famously.
I believe a girlfriend of mine had that above her bed.
Wow, that's interesting.
I'm just going to say that I did not measure up. Just...
Thank you for being honest. I think our listeners may appreciate that bit of vulnerability there, I guess. I'm not sure. Yeah. But it's that's a little tangential to what we're talking about here.
About death metal inspiring joy and not violence.
Yes. So this was an interesting study, I think. Like how they went about deciding whether or not... death metal is aspiring violence. And I guess it's really, well, okay. That's another problem I have with this article in some ways, because it's not really measuring whether they are it's making people violent. It's whether they're desensitized to violence when being shown these images of violent acts.
That's the better way to... kind of word the article. Yeah, like, I guess this is I didn't realize we had a couple of bad headlines.
Yeah.
In this batch. But this was more about just because there is more morbid imagery in heavy metal in general.
Sure.
People...
A darker feel to the music, I would say.
Yeah, darker feel to the music. A lot of people think that desensitizes you to violence. And
this song in particular is the lyrics are involving someone wanting to be eaten.
Because they are cannibalism themed track.
Yeah, the song is called Eaten.
yeah.
Some people were, I guess, thought that this could lead to some desensitization when it comes to violence. But the way that they didn't just like ask people, hey, did you think that was violent, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, say, or something like that. It wasn't like a survey. They were apparently playing either the song Eaten by the band Bloodbath or Happy by Pharrell, which they determined, I guess, is the musical opposite of of death metal. I don't know if they like plugged that into an algorithm. They asked Alexa. I don't know. Somehow they determined that that was the opposite of death metal. And they, that's another thing, Kevin. Like, how can they, maybe they're testing the wrong songs. Like, it could be like Barry Manilow or something. If they played that would like incite some type of violent reaction in people.
It is possible.
It's kind of based already on sort of like assumptions, I guess. I mean, how music affects us.
There are some pop songs that would probably drive me to more violent acts than heavy metal.
Friday by Rebecca Black, maybe. I don't know. There's some songs out there that, that maybe death metal is getting too bad a rap. In the minds of these researchers.
It's, you know, it's got to be in your wheelhouse if you're even thinking about studying this, right? Or at least on your radar somehow.
Well, you're probably right that somebody would be like, all right, look, Well, you know, that's annoying. Rebecca Black, I get it. But did you ever hear of a death metal? Because it seems like that might be more of an obvious choice.
Well, yeah.
Maybe we should knock down the low-hanging fruit first here.
It's kind of like still kind of doubling down on disproving that, you know, the anti-Christianness of heavy metal. Though there are anti-Christian factions within heavy metal, I would say it is not all uniformly that way.
Yeah. I was just trying to read through this article more, but I don't think there's anything that really backs up the idea that it leads to joy other than the quote from the professor at the end. But I did not see it explained in terms of the research results as to why he would be saying that the overwhelming response to this music is joy. But I don't know. I could see why people would react that way, I guess. It kind of was a, you know, powerfully emotional sort of music. Just maybe not to everyone's taste, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Like, that. There's so many things in my life that I'm just like, whatever. Like, I remember it's, and I think it's just because there is a group for everyone now. Like, I mean, it's another we're old things. Like, when I hear people talk about being from the 80s when they're younger than us, I just always, like, tilt my head a little bit.
Being from the 80s?
But I remember being a nerd and being kind of not cool with you.
Oh, well, yeah. That's always funny to me when people are saying stuff like...
were legitimately not cool.
It's kind of funny today because you'll hear people say like, oh, well, yeah, nerds are cool now. And then somebody might say, oh, well, nerds were always kind of cool. I'm like, oh, no.
No.
There was a time when that was not the case at all. And, yeah.
So I guess...
The movie Revenge of the Nerds, of course. I don't know. Could that have been the turning point? Looking back, they were not that cool in that movie.
I did rewatch that somewhat. Like, I think we were doing some house cleaning while I was on, so I did not like dedicate myself to watching it.
Yeah,
but I did do some watching of it, and yeah, it.
There's some morally disturbing stuff going on in that movie that our heroes engage in. So yeah,
yeah, there are some questionable things going on in that entire movie.
Right. But, yeah, that could have been the turning point when the nerds began to, as they say, get their revenge.
Win the cultural war.
Yeah. And maybe in some time, yeah, overstep their bounds in some cases. Yeah, there was a time before that when nerds were not cool.
Yeah, and I guess I feel like just starting with that, like, I've always been on the side of things that aren't terribly popular. Hockey, favorite sport, not terribly popular. More popular in these northern parts of the world than it is in the southern parts, though there are definitely some hockey hotbeds and some warm places.
I would say being a fan of soccer maybe is a similar situation.
Soccer is definitely in that. I mean, we kicked off the show talking about football. Like, I'm just like, whatever, man. Like, you can like as much stuff as you're allowed to. Like, that, it kind of cracks me up that people just...
How much stuff are you allowed to like?
As much as you want.
Okay. You just said you're allowed... You said you can like as much stuff as you're allowed to, and I just wanted to figure out how much your stuff you're allowed to. But...
Hey, as long as you can watch it, you can enjoy it.
Sure.
Like, it kind of cracks me up that, I don't understand why people don't like just sports all in general. Like, even my friends online kind of, like, draw lines for which ones that they do and don't like. And it's just like, just watch. Like, all of them are great. Like, they're all great athletes.
Right. There's, like, a reason to get into it.
Yeah, there's a reason they're all professionals here. Like, so yeah, I mean, even though I feel like I still kind of skew to some things that are not terribly popular, I mean, even wrestling isn't terribly popular. what the site is based on.
Well, I would say it's probably maybe more popular than it's ever been, from what I can tell. It's like the cultural sort of space occupied by wrestling.
Yeah,
does seem to be pretty pervasive, I guess.
It is pretty crazy how much it can be everywhere, but there are less people watching it. But I also think that there are just more rabid fans also in general of certain things. And I mean, I do feel like I watch some stuff more than others. You know, like, I mean, I guess I said college and pro football. Like, I watch pro football more closely than I do college. You know, like, I guess there's still, like, some things that I pay more attention to than others within the sporting realm. But,
yeah,
I just say like it all, man.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. Good, why not?
Popular stuff, not popular stuff. Have at it, man. And anyway, that's why bad music or heavy metal music, I think, is definitely, and punk rock also, not terribly popular. I was, you know, back in the day, it was definitely something that my parents looked at as a little bit strange.
I guess I went the opposite way. I was listening to not popular music that was not edgy either. So, yeah, nobody respected that. Listening to Buddy Holly when you're, you know.
I still like my Buddy Holly. Well, I remember watching, because there were two different movies, because he was in La Bamba, but didn't he, the Buddy Holly story?
There was the Buddy Holly story. I think he was played by, oh my gosh, who's the guy who was like, Gary Busey, I think, played him.
Yeah, Gary Busey.
Which is just a crazy thing to think about, really.
Yeah, and like when I kind of looked at some of the pictures, I'm like, oh my god, that's Gary Busey. Like, it finally dawned on me, and they did a great job of making him look like Buddy Holly.
Oh yeah, I remember that too, thinking that.
If it weren't for the nose, I think.
That was obviously pre-CGI. not able to automatically de-age people, morph their faces to look like something else, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost like, just, I don't know. It's kind of weird because, like, seeing all the de-aging effects in movies lately, like Sam Jackson and Captain Marvel, the guy, Tony Stark's dad in Endgame just as a random example, like, just kind of thrown in there. But it's like, you know, this kind of de-aging effect that would have been impossible in movies when we were growing up. It's just kind of crazy.
Yeah, the CGI just in that in general, without really talking plot, was, that's one of those ones where I'm like, oh my god, like it's gotten to the point where it's kind of seamless. Yeah. And it's just like, wow, man, like it's
really good. It's good.
Yeah, it is really good.
They got good special effects these days, Kevin. so that's the one, and I think that is the good ones to go see at the movie, go out to see at the movies rather. At least that seems to be the way to do it to me. So, in some ways, it's a golden age of movies for those kind of movies, at least. Otherwise, I guess it's TV is the winner these days.
Well, Ken, speaking of movies.
Yes.
And, action movies.
This would have been during maybe the golden age of movies in a way. Back originally, this movie came out in 1979.
Yeah, Alien. I guess a little bit surprising to me because I feel like I had watched Alien a long time ago. And I feel like I probably watched it at your house originally.
I wouldn't doubt it. Growing up, my dad was a lover of monster movies, so we would watch quite a few of those.
Yeah, Midge and Ron were not we're not on board with that one.
So yeah, we would watch a lot of the scary movies at the Phillips house, and
I do remember watching Alien like a long time ago. Like, I know that I didn't obviously watch it in 79 when I was 3 years old, but...
You know, I...
It's one of the first horror movies I can really remember watching.
I have, like, fallen a little bit out of the genre, but I am a fan of, I guess, horror movies in general. And for me, the original Alien is kind of slow, I feel like. It's a really interesting idea, but, like, an original, kind of like a haunted house movie in space. There's like a, you know, alien creature on board. It comes out of the shadows and kind of grabs people, you know.
Yeah, and you don't really, because you don't see it for a decent chunk of the movie.
Right. So it is kind of like a weird, you know, a shocking moment when the chestbuster comes out of the guy's chest.
Yeah, that is one of those things you just never forget, in my opinion. Like, the first time I saw that scene, I about pooped myself.
But I think a lot of, like, the sort of, I don't know, horror aficionados would say that Alien is maybe the best movie of the series. But I would be one of the sort of people who would say that the second one was the better one, just because, I don't know. To me, it's more of a complete movie, and I feel like it's not... Oh.
Not as slow?
It moves along nicely, yeah. And it's like, the way it like brings the tension up throughout the movie, and I don't know. It's just a well-done movie, I feel like.
Yeah, that's a tight one. Like, that's one of those ones, you know, I think a lot of people list Alien and Aliens is one of those times where the sequel wasn't a bomb.
Right. And could have been better than the original.
Better. Like, it's in there with Godfather 2, I feel like, in conversations where the second one was better. Now, I don't know if it's as unanimous, maybe, as with The Godfather.
No,
I do think that there's some argument. But I'm with you. I'm more of an Aliens plural than Alien, despite the fact that I love both movies.
Yeah, both movies are good, though. And that's why I was excited to see this article that I shared here about the...
a high school in New Jersey. At North Bergen High School, they did Alien the Play. And, in this, New York Post post, they do have video of some of the special effects that, they had a budget of $3,500, but, Ridley Scott also ended up giving them, kicking in an extra $5,000.
Wow, that's nice.
Which was nice of him. And sure enough, because they were doing an encore of it, and lo and behold, none other than Ripley herself, Sigourney Weaver, Kevin's first hot woman in Hollywood, because of Ghostbusters.
Oh.
And Zool. Sigourney Weaver.
Right. Yeah. That
I knew her as Zool before I knew her as Ripley. I would venture a guess to say that.
That I think you're right. But, you know, Ripley being one of the iconic movie heroes of all time, I would say. Apparently she enjoyed this high school play as well. It's from all accounts.
This is in the Bad Headline Hall of Fame on OPA, in my opinion. The last one, I think that was more of a debunking.
Mm.
This one is a complete misdirection.
We just agree with it on a fundamental level.
Yeah, she was seen freaking out at high school play. She did, it would seem, react to the action that was going on.
Yeah.
After seeing the action that they had, it's great for a high school play.
The sets look really good. Like, there was some smoke effects, it looked like, some lighting.
The alien looks pretty much, you know, pretty solid, like the real alien. Like, I mean,
it was like a suit that somebody was going around in, you know, on the set. But there could have been a, you know, puppeteering elements of it as well.
Possibly, but yeah, I do believe that there is someone in it because they're shown like watering the alien in the one picture. I'd imagine that's because someone's in there.
But the, even like, I feel like the suits of the kind of the astronaut suits that the crew was wearing looked really really nice as well, like way above what I would have expected.
Yeah. So yeah, for $3,500 or even for $8,500, because they even did they had something latch on to the guy's face shield. And they did another one latching on to the guy's face that they showed as just a still picture. They did a lot of work, man, for that money. And that's, I mean, that's just got to be a lot of great practical experience for these kids that worked on it. Because that's just, that's a lot of set building, man.
Yeah, I would think that would be a great way to get attention, you know, to let it drop that you were worked on this play. So that's going to help these kids out, I would think. And, you know, good on them for working so hard. And you can tell in the final product there that we can see. I assume that the actors are good too. At least it seemed like that from the article. We didn't get as much of that from the video. I don't think they wanted to give away everything, but
no.
The and I say also good on them for going with a non-traditional piece for the play. You know, I don't believe, I mean, that anyone has, any other high schools have done this as a play before. So yeah, way to go on.
I do believe the guy, and I should probably pull up his name.
Did they have to adapt this all to, as a play? I am guessing someone would have to like actually write this as a play to kind of, you know, give people lines and all that stuff. And
yeah. Director Perfecto Cuervo adapted the film into a 90-minute intermissionless play.
Oh, wow.
Cause they said that exploding eggs, hibernation pods, detailed spaceship operation panels, and more required a crew of about 20 students. Which, I mean, that's a lot of work even for 20 students.
Yeah. I mean, you might get more people interested in this potentially, I guess, because it is an exciting, you know, potentially exciting, I would think, choice as a, for a play.
So yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty badass, man. I love it.
I kind of want to see the whole thing now, but, you know, maybe someday it'll be available online somewhere.
Maybe your daughter will star as Ripley in a couple of years in a high school play.
Oh, now you've given me an idea. I try to make that happen somehow. Let go of her, you bitch.
Talk them into doing Aliens instead of Alien.
Right. It's like, listen, this one's been done before. I mean, it was great. I just think we can move on and do something a little better. You probably have to have more of a budget for the, you know, mobile loading suit that she fought the alien queen with in the climax of that movie. I don't know. Might have to see if we can hit Ridley up for a solid 10G. Maybe make that happen.
Oh man.
See if we can make Sigourney freak out again. I can't wait.
Yep. Well, Ken, someone that could pitch in 10 G's right now would be James Holzhauser.
Oh, right, you are, Kevin.
Because now he has become the second leading winner in Jeopardy history, trailing only Ken Jennings.
in terms of the winning streak?
In terms of the winning streak.
Number of days, yes.
Number of days. Ken Jennings has 74 consecutive victories, which is still a miles off. But this gentleman has a couple of articles, one from the New York Post, the other from Wired.com, talk about his earning rate. Like, even though tonight, as of this recording, was his 21st victory, he has earned $1.6 million, just to round off.
Which is by far and away the largest amount of money that a Jeopardy contestant has won.
Yeah, because Ken Jennings, during his 74 victories, only came to 2.5.
Oh, okay. So he's on pace then for a much higher total. If he would somehow get to 70 wins at this point.
I would think that if he's more than halfway there after 21, if he even doubled to 42, that he would shatter the record without. And it was kind of funny because the Wired article talked to Ken Jennings about it, and I do remember him saying back in the day that he expected the record to get broken, but he's a little bit surprised that it stood this long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because this is another one that was like, when did Ken Jennings do this? Because 15 years ago.
Oh,
like,
right.
I felt, yeah, that was like, a while ago. That was one of those ones that I'm like, oh my God, like, I, you know, that's a one that was as an adult. I'm like, ah, damn, man, that was a while ago now.
Yeah,
you know, I get that.
I remember
kind
that being
a
like
long
a big
time
deal
for a streak to happen. Yeah, because that was just kind of a cultural phenomenon. Now this one has kind of pushed its way in there, just because this guy James Holzhauser is winning a poop ton of money. Which Ken Jennings kind of admitted that he was a little frugal with his money,
right?
And this guy is not evidently is a professional gambler.
That was interesting. Yeah, we've been watching some of it here at the Phillips house. I've been recording Jeopardy.
Oh, okay.
Checking it out every so often, and yeah, he was a professional gambler. He has an interesting strategy, I think, of going after, like, well, I guess a lot of players do this, but he goes after like the high value stuff early. And he's very good at timing his buzzing, which is something that throws off a lot of players, I feel like. Because if you, like, buzz in too early, it will, like, disable your buzzer for, like, a short period of time.
Oh.
So, like, there's people who, like, buzz in too early, and then they're, like, trying to click in, but they can't. If he's very good at timing that out. And he's got a really good sense of trivia knowledge in general. Like, you can tell he's probably like memorized like all the world capitals and stuff like that.
Gotcha.
You know, when that's those kind of questions come up, he's like pretty automatic, it seems like. And he's really good at making, I guess, risky moves when he feels like he can do it. He'll bet like $20,000, $10,000 during a daily double, which I feel like I've never seen on Jeopardy, someone betting that much money.
Yeah, that sounded pretty bonkers, just because, yeah, people, and even Ken Jennings said it, you know, he just kind of played it safe.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to really
maximize your possible winnings. Yeah.
Yeah, and this guy's, and I mean, I've got to imagine that every now and again he gets one wrong.
I did watch a game where he actually came pretty close to losing it out. But the thing, okay, now this is a little bit of a conspiracy theory. So I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on for this little section of the podcast. But you can really get screwed on the final Jeopardy question of Jeopardy. Because you have to bid before you see the question. The category is not always a very good indicator of what it's going to be.
Yeah, it's always pretty vague. And yeah. I mean, I have not watched a lot of Jeopardy recently, but it was at least traditionally pretty.
Mm-hmm. So you can find yourself in a bad spot there.
Yeah.
And I feel like the final Jeopardy questions that I've seen with him have been maybe easier than normal. So if somebody wanted to create a streak, I feel like making easier than average final Jeopardy questions would be a good way to kind of continue that streak, because it gives him kind of puts him like in the driver's seat almost.
Uh-huh.
If he's putting himself, you know, as the leader going into final Jeopardy.
Oh, right.
So that's my kind of conspiracy theory brain going there. But I don't know if there's I haven't done any analysis to kind of compare the difficulty or perceived difficulty of the Final Jeopardy questions vis-a-vis what the category is that they give. That was always tough for me. Like, I don't know how you can know how much you're going to bid for Final Jeopardy, because it could be something completely obscure that you would have no idea.
Oh, yeah. It always seemed pretty tough to me. Like, there were not... Like, I always felt good kind of playing the game, but Final Jeopardy was one of those things that was never a strong suit when I watched mm-hmm. on a regular basis.
No, I feel like I almost tune out a little bit then sometimes, but yeah, it has been more interesting with this guy, because you kind of want to see what happens. And he usually is pretty good at closing things out, so... The one that I did see him struggle, I think he was only ahead by like $80 or something like that. So oh, that wow. was a really close one. But he kind of squeaked through that one. But yeah.
Yeah, hey, if you're ahead, you're ahead.
That's all it takes.
But yeah, I mean, that's pretty crazy that the guy is just kind of going for it. Like, I mean, and I guess we've talked about it in relative terms to football, where we'd be, we are definitely proponents of going for it more frequently on fourth down. Yeah, like, it seems like gambling is worth, like, it backfires, but it's worth, you know, like if you kind of total everything up, it's worth going for it.
Well, and if you are really good at trivia, yeah, it's especially worth going for it. You know, similar to the, as much as we hate them, the New England Patriots being good on offense historically with Tom Brady as their quarterback. You want to go forward and fourth down more often than not, just because you're good things are going to happen. And when you're James Holzhauser or whatever on Jeopardy, you want to keep going on answering questions, because chances are you're going to have a pretty good shot at answering it. So. That's just, it just makes sense.
Yep. Well, Ken, our last topic, I cannot find a good transition for.
Oh, well, that's all right. I guess we've been talking about being a fan of things.
It has some been ways. A very kick it old school. Although this one, I would say that you've introduced me to Gene Wolfe more recently than, you know, longer ago.
Mm-hmm.
You've given me many a book over the years.
This was one of my favorite authors of science fiction and author in general, I guess. Gene Wolfe was a science fiction author. And his stories were always very, very deep, and sort of you had to pay more attention than you would at sort of like most other authors, I feel like, because there's things happening that are not at all obvious on first reading. Such, you know, things such as characters dying, like main characters dying, and you not realizing it. You know.
Yeah, now I will say that you have not given me, as this article mentions, his piece de resistance.
Oh, yeah. I feel like that's probably should be next on on the reading list there, maybe. Because that is a good one for sure.
You did give me the Soldier series, which does play to a lot of the themes that they mentioned in the article, and you kind of talked about how complicated it is and how much you need to pay attention. Like, that was definitely that series. It became easier to read after you kind of got into it.
Right.
To me, like, the first, probably, like, half of that first book was just kind of tough. Mm-hmm. But once you kind of got into that headspace, it's like, oh, I want to reread that first half now. Then, you know, like, it's going to all make a little more sense now. I haven't gone back to reread it yet.
No.
Because... It did start to make more sense when you kind of found the logic.
Well, yes, that's a great example, I think, because he usually sticks to whatever the kind of conceit of the story is, because oftentimes it's not like a straight up narrative. Like, it's a lot of times there's a character that's telling the story, or you're getting like one side of things.
That was kind of interesting when I was reading the article. I'm like, oh, it's kind of the same conceit in all of his books in some ways. Although there are different things that it would seem go on in the books. Kind of the point of view, I guess maybe you'd say, of the book is somewhat similar
From book to book. Somehow there's an unreliable narrator, I feel like, in a lot of his books. So... Yeah, so an example of the Soldier books, the narrator is not trying to be unreliable, but he has a memory problem where he forgets everything that happens 12 hours after it happens, basically.
Oh, I thought they gave him 24 hours.
Oh, okay. For some reason I had 12 hours stuck in my head, but...
But yeah, he always basically needed to write it. If he didn't write down what happened before he went to bed, he couldn't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that you got in the book was what he wrote.
So the book itself was his writing, like his, I guess, diary, if you will,
which
he kept on a scroll and wrote in super small letters, apparently. I think in the beginning of the book, like the prologue, that he describes someone having found this scroll and translated it from the original Latin, I believe.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah,
because the soldier was from Rome, if I'm not...
Although, yeah. There were clues to that, although I think he himself did not know where he was from.
Correct.
Being an amnesiac. So, but it is interesting because I think it, like he mentioned, the scroll was not even like broken up into like paragraphs or chapters or anything. So like the name of each chapter is actually like from the sentence that he wrote. If you ever noticed that, you know, like if you said, if you ever go back and look at it, like the first few words of the chapter title actually leads into what the sentence is.
Oh.
So it's like they chose some of those words to use as like wherever they thought there was natural breaking. Like they'll usually stop, like the chapter will end when he stopped writing from the day or something, you know.
Oh, okay.
And then start up the next chapter, supposedly the starts with the heading from that's taken from his writing. So, you know, little stuff like that is kind of interesting when you pick up on it. And then also like picking up on things that he himself is not aware of, but maybe you've pieced together. is interesting.
Because he doesn't have a long-term memory, like he doesn't necessarily remember. Yeah. Some of the further events.
And it's interesting because sometimes it'd be like, oh, okay, I just sat down and read this book or read this scroll. And he's like, oh my God. It's like, I can't believe everything that's going on.
Yeah, shit got crazy, man, is basically what he's saying.
But then there'll be like other times when he'll be busy and like hasn't had time to read and like we'll just be writing you know, without necessarily knowing what's going on sometimes. So it's, or there'll be periods like where there'll be a break in between and you'll kind of have to figure out what happened in between. So it can be a challenging, to read sometimes because he's not really, spoon feeding it to you. It is almost like, oh no, this was just a scroll that we found and, you know, we didn't have everything. But I think in a way he's being smart about like kind of directing your attention to like thinking about those things that aren't there and kind of trying to piece together what could be there. And I think I like that in reading fiction. So,
well, yeah. And I guess that's one of those things that I wasn't surprised in this article from The Ringer that he was never terribly popular, I guess. And, I do think that some people would probably be turned off by trying to figure out, you know, the beginning of the Soldier series. Because I know that people don't like Lord of the Rings because they get a little too bogged down and stuff.
Yeah, this is definitely kind of...
It's a different type of bogging down, in my opinion.
You know, yeah, this is definitely for... I don't know, grown-ups, I guess I'd say. Not to be too disparaging, but, you know, I would say this is off the trend of, like, the popularity of adults reading young adult fiction. You know, all the grown-ups reading Harry Potter and the Hunger Games trilogies. This is not that, I guess, I would say.
No. I did enjoy reading the Harry Potter series, but yeah, it's this is a different grade level. Like, the kids are not going to be joining in the Gene Wolfe reading, I don't think.
Right.
It's a little dense, and I think that a lot of kids probably wouldn't really want to dive into Lord of the Rings, although it's obviously some of us do.
Yeah. But it is like, if you kind of go into it knowing all that, and I think open to the experience, it's, really worth your while to check out. If you can find some time to read in this crazy, crazy world these days, it's worth checking out. And there's some of those books on, audiobook as well. If people are interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah. And we talked about The Soldier a lot. You also did give me, The Knight. Which was, that one was good. I thought that was a little easier of a read, among, you know.
But even that one was like a letter that the narrator is writing to his brother, supposedly.
Oh, correct.
That takes the form of a book. I always like the letter being the manuscript that you're reading as part of the story. That I don't know. Maybe that's another reason I like his writings. Because that always got to me. Like, that was with The Call of Cthulhu, H.P. Lovecraft, I believe, was the same thing. Because it was like a series of letters that you're kind of like putting the story together. I always liked that.
H.P. Lovecraft, that's definitely one that's been a long time since I've read those.
Another not young adult author.
we are good at suggesting... Oh, actually, you know what? I'm not sure that I read the newest Soldier.
Oh, yeah.
The third one, because I forgot that one was a relatively recent one.
That was pretty good. And I think the other thing that's interesting about these Soldier novels is that I believe he did a lot of research, it seems to me. Like, a lot of the details, the historical details and things that kind of get thrown in there about just everyday life in ancient Greece in this case.
Oh, yeah.
Is interesting, and the last of those novels, which I guess will never get a sequel, was taking place in ancient Egypt. He travels there.
Oh, yeah, because that is certainly something that doesn't dawn on you very well until you get your orientation about where his travels are in the book.
Yeah, I think they call Egypt Kemet or something like that, and then later they call it the Black Land. So like, yeah, it's like you have to kind of, that's another thing. Like it's not like you even know where things are. You kind of like put it together and realize that it's like some kind of clever, reference or something. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of math to do in his books. So, and because which one is it? Oh, the Book of the New Sun is
probably his most famous. I'd say, yeah,
it is the most famous one, and it's 4 books.
Yeah, that one takes place in the far future. Kind of the sun is burning out, and there is a sort of unusual path, I guess, to solving that problem. That so the main character in that one is a torturer.
Oh, yeah, and he gets shunned away from his... It's like he was a child molester in the Catholic Church, and but he was nice to someone, even though he was a torturer, and got pushed to another city.
Right, yes. And then potentially becomes some sort of savior figure to solve the problem of their son. I don't know. It's an interesting... now, that's an example of an unreliable narrator who has lots of reasons to put one over on the reader. In the story of like how this book is written. So there's people debate a lot of kind of like the truthfulness of some of the stuff in that book, but like whether it quote really happened as he said or not. For some things.
Gotcha. So
that's another one that's kind of a you know, you have to put things together, and it's also one that's written to audiences of his time. So like he'll use words that don't mean, like we have to kind of piece together what he's talking about. And it's not like something that, you know, it's like, hey, well, this is the way it was written. Like he's not going to explain, Gene Wolfe is not going to explain it to us. It's just going to be like, you know, you have to figure out what a peltast is, or I don't know, with these other kind of archaic words that he throws in there.
I did have to laugh at the one word that the article mentioned that was used was oubliette, and I'm just like, oh yeah, that's a beer from Seventh Son. It was all, and I'm like, yeah, I guess I don't know what it really means. Like, I do know that it's a beer, but I'm not completely.
I think I only know that because it was a magic card. So that was my nerdy reason for knowing what that one meant. I think it's the place of forgetting it means. And it's like some kind of a underground prison or something along those lines. Let's see if that's...
Wikipedia isn't even giving us is a type of dungeon.
Yeah. So, yeah, there you go. That's your... don't say you don't learn things by listening to the show. Now you all know what an oubliette is. Be sure to bring it up in casual conversation.
Yeah, and not sound nerdy at all doing that.
No, of course not. Well, then you just get your revenge, Kevin, as we covered earlier.
Yep. Okie doke, Ken. Well, unfortunately, the ribs got revenge on me this week, Ken. The pork fought back and decided to stay lodged in my throat. I was not able to have a Belltime beer. I believe you consumed one, though.
I just went back to the Great Lakes IPA, their newest offering, and the verdict is still thumbs up. So,
outstanding.
If you haven't tried it, go for it.
Good to hear. They do have one of the larger distributorships within the OPA listening region.
Greater OPA land area. Yeah. Yeah. So give it a shot.
And yeah, with that, DeFrango 11 at Gozer 33. I almost said at Granny Mays. I don't know why. Wow,
crazy. It must have looked like Jeremy over here.
The brand is at Stunt Granny. Rate and review us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you may listen to us, and have a good night.
See ya.